From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll discuss the importance of civility and how it can be achieved through building better relationships. We'll tell you about a documentary that explores how three strangers in Milwaukee became connected through a weekend of gun violence.
We talk about the homicide rate, but at least six times as many people get shot and are injured and maimed by shooting. That causes a ripple effect through families, and we have to start addressing this.
Plus, we'll take you to the Escuela Verde New Line Community Cafe, a place for young people to learn life skills.
We want this space to be inclusive, not just representative of the cultures that represent Silver City, but also inclusive in education, inclusive in the idea that anybody, any student, can bring what they want into this space and be successful.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here's today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. The political landscape may feel more divided than ever, and civility amongst those whose ideologies don't align may seem in short supply. But UW-Milwaukee professor Bill Keith says civility is still attainable. Not only does he believe it's possible, but he says it's necessary to a functioning democracy. Keith is the co-author of a book called Beyond Civility, The Competing Obligations of Citizenship. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about it earlier this year.
What do you think civility in general means right now in this moment that we're living in?
I think civility, I can't decide. I've been talking to people about that, is that there's a project I've been working on for now about 7 years. And did I choose the perfect time for a book to come out or the worst possible time for a book to come out? So a lot of people are very concerned about civility now. They're concerned about a loss of it. They're concerned about recovering it. But why is it so important to people? That's a really good question. And I think it's important to people because we have a political system in which the way we understand that political system is that it works basically through people talking to each other and talking to each other on a number of different levels, right? So you have the debates that happen within the U.S. Senate that's talking. You have the entire media ecosystem in which arguments and ideas and images flow back and forth. You also have the talking that you do with people you know, some of whom you may know a little bit. You may have a conversation with your postal carrier, some people you know very well, with family members about public topics. So the United States, as a kind of democracy, does seem to make decisions based on the outcomes of large conversations. And so if we look at over the last 20 years, the way in which things have changed relative to marriage equality. 20 years ago, it was hard to talk about the legalization of gay marriage. It was difficult. People got angry. It seemed impossible. It seemed like there were legal barriers. And after about 10 years of conversation on many different levels, then it sort of became somehow obvious that this probably was okay and had to happen. Are there still a minority of people who disagree? Of course. There's always a minority of people who disagree, but that doesn't prevent us from actually moving forward. So that's a case where the conversations, the arguments, the flow of discourse, mostly civil, sometimes a little bit less, did seem to make a positive change. But now we're in a period of time where we feel like this is spiraling out of control, that somehow talk is actually working against us and it's not productive.
I think that gets to this idea of civility, the necessity of it, but also the limitations of it. We're living in a moment where people can't agree on basic facts. People can't agree that, you know, the grass is green, as it were. How do you use civility in a situation where just the core principles of people seem to be so divergent?
So I want to reframe that a little bit and make it a more general point about the way that we look at public discourse and government as well. So a lot of times people will say, oh, government is terrible. Politicians are terrible. Surveys have shown for decades that people say politicians are terrible and dishonest and greedy, except for mine. The person I elected, they're great. It's just everybody else. Right. So there is a bias built into the way that we talk about this. When people say they don't like government, they're usually talking about the latest drama at the national level. They're not talking about their local government, which may actually work pretty well. So when you say we can't agree on basic facts, actually, we mostly do agree on basic facts. So there is this moment we have in all the agreements that we have about how things work and how stoplights work and all this stuff, where certain things become politicized. I think we can agree on the color of the grass. That will work. We can't seem to agree on masks, even though a lot of people think that's pretty much as factual as the grass. So then the question is, okay, you have these pain points, these problems where things are heavily polarized, heavily politicized. And that is where it's difficult. And so you're calling in civility to solve the problem, which in some ways has moved past that. But of course, the point of civility is to try to maintain enough of a relationship with people so that you can actually disagree with them. And this is one of the things that we talk about in the book, is the difference between weak civility and strong civility. Weak civility is behaviors and norms that sort of maintain the appearance of ease and comfort and belonging. And this is equivalent to just strategically ignoring things that are difficult. So when people say, okay, at the Thanksgiving dinner table or whatever, we're not going to talk about politics or religion, that's weak civility. So people, in a sense, are being civil. They talk about the weather and sports and other things, but they don't get to places that are hard. A democracy requires strong civility, which is a set of behaviors and norms that allow people to disagree and disagree deeply. And so what's lost right now is the feeling that we're able to do productive disagreement. So a lot of the things end up people shouting, you know, their own truths at each other without actually engaging each other. And of course, social media is a huge complication to the entire process.
Social media is especially the place that I think a lot of people encounter this. You know, getting back to this idea of just core facts, we just witnessed an insurrection at our nation's capital. Is civility what we use in that moment, or is civility divorced from that?
So in general, I think when the violence begins, you've crossed the line and civility is no longer the thing which is in play. The point of civility is to allow people to disagree without it turning into violence. And so once it turns into violence, you've left that place. Right? Because in America, for the most part, we don't use violence for political ends. We don't solve political problems through assassinations and bombings. Now, conspiracy groups, conspiracy theories are not new to the U.S. They were part of the founding. In the middle of the 19th century, there was the Know-Nothing Party, which was basically a white supremacist conspiracy party in which they didn't want people to actually realize what they were about. So if they were asked about it, they would say, I know nothing. And that's how they earned that name. In the 1930s, we had on the radio a new technology at that time, Father Coughlin, who spread anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, in particular cast at President Roosevelt. So these things we've had all along. So the question is, like, what's different now? People have always been able to get together and talk about their ideas, some of which, as you say, are fringe, some which seem ludicrous, but obviously they take them quite seriously. Civility is a kind of relationship with people. So if you have this relationship, then you're able to do disagreement with each other. You're able to critique each other's ideas and arguments without breaking the relationship. Social media does not foster those kinds of relationships. Social media relationships are incredibly shallow, right? So people read posts, they click like or dislike, they share things on Twitter, they don't share things on Twitter. Twitter and Facebook are set up to make money. Every time someone clicks, somebody gets paid. The things that make people click tend to be the things that make people angry. Extreme emotion is what drives those. Now, when you think about civil relationships, especially in the sense of strong civility, they're not typically driven by drama. You probably know people in your life that you've had long-running arguments with about what is the correct shape of government or about a specific policy, what should we do about immigration or prison reform or whatever. And you've had this disagreement and you've gone back and forth over maybe many years. That's a strong relationship. That's a relationship of strong civility. In strong civility, you should also be able to call people out. Civility is coming together as civil society, making people uncomfortable and doing the right thing and yelling at people who are not doing the right thing when you have to. The possibility for loud disagreement is built into civility, but it really can't cross the line. And part of the problem now, too, is that the way in which we have understood our public relationships, we used to think, you know, we're all in this together. We're two different parties, but we're all Americans. We share U.S. history, et cetera. But now people are starting to get into relationships with each other where they say, well, no, we have the real truth, and those people aren't Americans. They're not just wrong, they're evil. People, you know, they have their own kind of media consumption, and they've gotten interested and they've read a bunch of things that have led them to think this certain thing is very plausible, and you find it ridiculous. So, okay, how do you engage that, right? You, in good faith, find it ridiculous. They, in good faith, find it plausible. So what do you do about that? How do you talk to a flat earther or an anti-vaxxer? Or I want to say that if you think of it in a sort of a close confine there, I'm just talking to this person who I otherwise don't know about this one difficult hot button issue. You're really not going to get anywhere. Civility is not your friend. Civility is a network of behaviors and norms in a relationship over time. So you really have to ask yourself, what is my relationship with this person? And have I laid the groundwork to be able to have this kind of disagreement with them? Is there the trust there that we could actually listen to each other? Because, of course, you find what they're talking about ridiculous, but you should be, on the grounds of strong civility, listening to what they have to say as well, right? And not starting from the position that, well, I'm right and they're wrong, and so how do I get them to believe what I do? That isn't actually very civil. So it's probably true that what you need to do is begin building relationships with people on things that you do actually agree about. And there's a lot of stuff you do agree about. Because, of course, it's much easier to have policy arguments when you already agree about 95% of things. It's harder to do it when it's only 70% or 50%. But for most people, there are a lot of things that they do agree about. There's values that they share in common, and those become points for moving forward. Does that pre-exist the conversation you're having? Probably not. So you have to do the work to develop it. Whatever that background of agreement is that'll allow you to move forward, you have to work on that, and you have to keep working on that, right? It doesn't automatically come. And so it's sort of deceptive. You can watch certain kinds of talk shows on TV where everybody's basically in the same place and they have these conversations. They're really interesting and really interesting arguments and the way they use evidence. But that's a kind of artificial situation. The ones in our daily lives typically aren't like that.
What is the end goal of civility?
It is keeping the dialogue going. It's keeping the discussion alive. Part of the way that we think about democracy is that so the people decide. People don't decide blindly. They sort of decide on the basis of these ongoing long-term conversations about things. So if you go back 100 years, first you have the creation of the income tax, then you have the reforms of the New Deal. These were the result of people talking about things are broken and they need to change. There was a lot of discourse during the 1930s about how did we end up here? What is so broken? What do we need to change? And that provided the basis for accepting many of the reforms that Roosevelt had. So the thing is not that we should all end up agreeing. Because at a certain point, but also not that we should understand ourselves as winners and losers, that we evolve better and better policies. Basically, the way liberal democracy seems to work is that we see a set of problems, we try solutions. Solutions have their own weaknesses and problems. We try to address those, and so on, right? There is no point at which we get a perfect government, a perfect set of policies, or that we all agree. We should have disagreement. We should have people poking holes and making objections because that improves our chances at doing this kind of problem solving. But right now it's very hard to do because in the public sphere, people seem very dug in and they seem, especially if you're on social media, more interested in yelling at each other and calling each other names than in doing anything that's helpful.
Well, Bill, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
My pleasure.
Bill Keith is a professor in the English department at UW-Milwaukee and the co-author of Beyond Civility, The Competing Obligations of Citizenship. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers back in March. The documentary When Claude Got Shot shows how one weekend of gun violence linked three strangers here in Milwaukee. While visiting town for a high school reunion, Claude Motley was shot in the face during an attempted carjacking. Victoria Davison is a nurse with a concealed carry permit who shot a person trying to rob her two nights later. Nathan King is the assailant in both cases. He was 15 years old at the time. The film follows the 5 years of Claude's life after the shooting as he tries to recover mentally and physically while staying involved in the criminal justice journey of his shooter. The film explores the complicated issue of gun violence and humanizes each person's perspective and their struggles with what justice or punishment should look like. The film was directed by Brad Lichtenstein of 371 Productions here in Milwaukee and has now been nominated for an Emmy. Lichtenstein and Motley spoke with me about the film last year. Lichtenstein begins by explaining how his and Motley's relationship set the foundation for the documentary.
Claude and I go back 18 years, actually, when I first moved to Milwaukee. I met Claude because our sons, my oldest son, his only son, attended UWM childcare together. And Claude and I met one night when they did like a parents' dinner thing, and we sat in those teeny little chairs together. So did our wives. I mean, we met the whole family and we just started talking and became friends. So we've been friends for all these years. And that's really why the trust and the ability to tell the story was able to materialize, because we already had that relationship in place.
Yeah. And if I, you know, and also, you know, the thing about it is, I don't think it could have happened if it wasn't in this type of situation. It was, I mean, a lot of things, you know, sometimes when things happen, you know, especially a person that was involved in it, you start to ask me a question, why? And one of those answers was because I had the opportunity to bring the story out, you know, and, you know, why did I survive? Why did it happen to me and things like that? So I took that as a sign, as in, hey, listen, let's go ahead and shine some light to the things that's happened in Milwaukee and for years and years and years. And you know, Brad gave me that vehicle, and I had a lot of trust in him to put the story together, you know, to actually, you know, say that and express that. So I'm deeply indebted to that.
Brad, as you decided, yes, we're going to move through with this, and can you share a little bit about how you were brainstorming, how you wanted to shape this story? Because on one hand, you're very close with one subject, but yet there's another fuller story to tell, but also be respectful of your friendship, of Claude's point of view. How did you grapple with how this could come together?
Well, you know, first of all, there's always this kind of like toggle between I'm Claude's friend and I'm also a filmmaker working with Claude on a film. But I'd say pretty early on, I knew that I wanted to tell a kind of 360 degree story around gun violence. And so I wanted to include Nathan King, who was 15 when he shot Claude, and then 2 days later was shot himself when he and a similar crew of kids tried to rob Victoria Davison. She had a conceal and carry weapon and she shot Nathan. And the first time I talked to Victoria, I learned that this idea of a hero who uses a gun to defend herself is mostly a myth. And it's complicated because on the one hand, if she hadn't had a gun, she may very well have been killed herself. Maybe, maybe not. But more importantly, she was devastated by having shot a 15-year-old boy. She, like Claude, like me, we all have kids. And, you know, immediately your mind goes to what it feels like to be a parent and potentially lose your child, which is also ultimately what happened to Nathan King's mother, who has a huge void in her life because her son went away to prison. So, you know, from the beginning, it felt like there was a way to really dig deep into gun violence with deeply personal stories and to help the audience see how many ripple effects there are from, in this case, you know, just a weekend of gun violence.
And as you guys mentioned, the narrative around shootings and the people who commit them, as well as those who are shot, are so brief. And Claude, throughout the film, you're always reaffirming that you are more than what happened to you. So as a Milwaukee native, obviously being aware of all the issues here, what did you feel was most important in sharing to show a bigger picture about gun violence with your story?
Well, and that was one of the main things that I wanted to talk about when we started this venture, is that it's so hard. There's so many things are stacked up against us, especially in Milwaukee with this segregated history and with the racism within this country. You know, you're always fighting, you're always trying to strive to be, try to get to something successful and what you have in your mind, what is successful. And that's what, you know, we were doing, me, my wife and everything. We're all from Milwaukee, all our family is here. And we were trying to, you know, just do things that were, that can show, be an example to the community. And as we're back, you know, I get pulled back into the situation, which, you know, and the bad thing about it is that I grew up with that my whole life, you know, shootings, violence, drugs. You know, I mean, and I'm not trying to say that's all what Milwaukee's about. It's a beautiful place to be. I can't even express how much Milwaukee has made the person who I am, you know, and that includes all the empathy and the ability to go ahead and understand people's situations. So my whole goal was to say, you know, don't look at me as a victim. Look at me as a survivor, and I'm continuing to survive. You know, I survived my whole life through these things, through troubles and tribulations. And this is just another thing. But at one point in time, we need to help ourselves. We need to, you know, look and see, hey, listen, we can't allow the negative to overshine the positives. Let's pull together. Let's start to shine a light. Let's stop, you know, putting this in, you know, 60 second clips and start showing the ripple effects of what shootings are actually in this community. You know, we talk about the homicide rate, but at least 6 times as many people get shot and are injured and maimed by shootings. That causes a ripple effect through families and through everywhere, the trauma that it causes. And we have to start addressing this as for what it is. You know, this is almost like terrorism within our community that we have to root out, that is not getting the attention on a national basis, you know, and it's more of blaming the victim for being in the situation that they're in. And it's just not, it's not right, you know, and I wanted to actually be able to say that to a large group of, you know, a large audience.
And on that note, you know, in news stories and brief summaries, we hear the victim survived, they're alive, and people kind of move on. But this film shows your 10 surgeries over 3 years, mounting medical bills, obviously the psychological trauma, and also the ripple effect on your family, your friends. And yet you were fighting, despite all this, to stay positive, to try and keep moving forward, move beyond it. You know, but how difficult is that? And how are you now compared to when you're in the heat of shooting and you're trying to keep moving forward, to not think too hard about that situation?
Well, you know, I mean, and let me, I don't want to diminish it. You know, PTSD is real, and it can definitely affect who you are as a person and your ability to actually get things together. For a while, I was spinning my wheels in the same place because it was hard to, you know, pick up the pieces and start moving forward. And then you have another surgery and you're back, you know, for a month and a half trying to recover. And it definitely was a very hardship, you know, a hardship on my life and my whole family's life. You know, I'm not going to diminish that. But because of the things that happened in Milwaukee and how I grew up, I was kind of prepared for this. I feel that everyone, all my family members, everyone that lives in Milwaukee has a level of PTSD that they've gone through just because of the shock of segregation, the shock of being oppressed the way they are and things like that. And they all are, you know, have to continue to strive and not really worry about the things that's holding them back, but continue to try to push forward. And that's what prepared me. That's why I said Milwaukee made me who I was. And I would not be able to do that if I didn't have that training and that thought process to always stay positive, regardless of the things that, you know, are trying to be thrown in front of you.
Something you said before Nathan's sentencing hearing that really stood out to me is, you know, are we trying to do this as a deterrence or are we trying to get justice? Can you both kind of talk about that dynamic of telling the story?
You know, one of the things that really frustrates me, and I said already that, you know, it was a real push to make Nathan as the perpetrator and the enemy. And, you know, once we solved his situation, we solved the problem. And I rejected that immediately, because when I look at this situation, you know, I have had people involved in the criminal justice system that are dear to me and have also come out of it a different person, have served their time and just wanted to become a productive citizen in this society. But a lot of times they don't get the chances. And it all starts with the attitudes toward them when they're going in. So when I looked at this whole situation, I wanted to make sure that people understood that when we're sending someone to jail, especially a person that, you know, I'm sitting here saying I want leniency for him, when we send these people to jail, we have to, there's a fine line between punishment and revenge. And I just did not, I really felt that a person that young, even though I wanted him to be in the adult courts and to have that punishment, but I didn't want to, I'm not trying to throw away the key on a person. I know that he can come back and we can as a community, and he just as me and him, we can overcome what happened and move forward.
I'd just like to add, I think what makes the documentary special is the deep humanity of Claude. And you get to go on this journey with him as he starts to unravel what it is that he wants out of this situation for himself and for the people involved. And one of the impacts that has is it contrasts with how rigid the system is. And when we're in the part of the film that's really weaving through the criminal justice system, and it culminates in the scene you just pointed out, Audrey, with the sentencing, you know, the judge doesn't listen to Claude. And up to this point, the assistant DA and the police have been saying how important it is to have the quote unquote victim's voice be part of this entire process. But when it came right down to it, and the moment of truth occurred, and Claude is asking that profound question of what are we really after here? The judge ignores him. He even says, you know, he has different concerns maybe than Kim and Claude do. And I think that's one of the deep tragedies in the film, beyond the bullets, is that the system is so entrenched that there's a level of indifference that that it has. And that's oppressive. That's systemic and historical racism, if you will, and not in the sense that it's necessarily targeting anyone in particular, but it is unable to respond to the facts on the ground. And the facts on the ground are that we have three people, all of whom are trying to wrestle with these difficult questions of how to respond to each other and treat each other and have relationships in the midst of all this. And that turned out to be way more human than the system that it's all taking place in.
Claude Motley is the subject of the documentary When Claude Got Shot, and Brad Lichtenstein is the director and president of 371 Productions here in Milwaukee. The documentary has been nominated for an Emmy for Exceptional Merit in Documentary Filmmaking. The Emmys will be held on September 12th. In about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about the Escuela Verde New Line Community Cafe, a place for young people to learn life skills. But first, we'll speak with a Milwaukee author about her new murder mystery book that takes place in a nursing home.
If you set a book in a nursing home, which is generally not a very attractive environment, for readers, right, or for anyone, then you need to give people something else to think about, including the characters in the novel.
That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Many of us think nursing homes as places where loved ones can be cared for towards the end of their lives. But what if these places could allow residents to relive cherished experiences through virtual reality? That's the idea behind The World of Pondside, a novel by Milwaukee author Mary Helen Stefaniak. The title comes from the VR game created by the character Robert, an elderly resident at Pondside Manor, and Foster, a young staff member. Together, they build portals based on the memories of each of Pondside's residents. When Robert is found dead, the game goes offline and panic takes over at Pondside. Foster is tasked with uncovering the mystery behind Robert's death before the game is shut down for good. WUWM's Chase Browning spoke with Stefaniak about the book back in April.
Mary Helen, thank you so much for being with me here on Lake Effect. It's a pleasure to talk with you today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
When I started reading your new novel, The World of Pondside, one of the first things I noticed was its unique cast of characters. I thought to myself, I've never read a book where the elderly and the young take center stage in a narrative. What inspired you to make this decision?
Well, that's actually an easy question to answer. My mother spent about 6 weeks in a nursing home, and she did not want to be there, which is not unusual for people in a nursing home. And so on her very first day, she refused to eat the lunch and she refused to eat the dinner. All right. So late that evening, she was very hungry. And so she and I went in search of something for her to eat. We went to the kitchen, not expecting anyone to be there, but there was one young man still working in the kitchen. He looked like he was doing sort of a wrap up, you know, or mop up. He wasn't cleaning, but he was, you know, getting things squared away. And we asked him if he could make a sandwich for my mother. And he looked a little taken aback. And he said, "Well, what kind of sandwich?" And I looked at my mom and she said, "Jelly, a jelly sandwich." And he did it. He made her a jelly sandwich. And she ate the whole thing. Is the first thing, you know, she had eaten since she got there. And it was the sort of kindness of that young man who asked no questions. You know, people in nursing homes are often on a certain kind of diet, or he could see this woman was hungry, I guess. And he made her that sandwich. So that's where the old and the young got into the story.
You know, I really loved how the Pondside residents and the young caregivers come together and bond over learning about computers. Mm. The virtual reality game, also called The World of Pondside, was developed by a resident named Robert, and he enlists a staff member named Foster to help him run the program. Soon enough, nearly everyone at Pondside is playing this virtual reality game. Is this a sort of commentary on the role that computers play in our social lives?
Perhaps it is sort of a commentary. It's perhaps people in a nursing home want to get in the game too. They don't need to be left out of it. I'm not really a gamer myself, although I have played many games, spent some time. It was research. You know, it wasn't fun or anything. It was just for research. I got to play all sorts of games with my son and my son-in-law and my grandson and granddaughter, who at the beginning of writing this book were very young, but they sort of, their computer game sophistication grew as the novel developed. So I have to thank all of them for helping me out with that.
Throughout the book, most of the residents play the VR game in order to relive familiar experiences with loved ones or from their childhood. But some people choose to imagine entirely new lives and explore exotic places. How did you develop the idea to combine all the possible experiences of VR with the end-of-life experiences that we think take place at a nursing home?
Well, you know, in the book, when Robert and Foster are working on the game, on creating portals for people, their own individual portals, they gather information from the person and photographs and videos and just stories, recordings, to use to create that individual's portal. And if you think about it, a person who's, you know, near the end of life has a lot of experiences they might want to return to, right? Or they do return to in their imagination all the time. In a sense, I feel as though the virtual reality game just uses their imagination as a springboard and also uses it in the course of playing the game. Since they're not wearing VR goggles, they're just sitting at a computer using the keyboard and the mouse. So you can tell that a lot of the kind of engine of the game is the imagination of the person playing it. And I think that's probably always true, but the better virtual reality gets, the less we need imagination. So I'm not sure that's a move in a positive direction. but in any case, in the world of Pondside, it's really the administrator of the nursing home, Kitty Landis, is the person who has a completely imagined portal. In her portal, she gets to be the fashion designer, you know, a la The Devil Wears Prada. she doesn't have a large store of memories to look back on that she wants to look back on. I mean, when you read the novel, you realize she just as soon not look back on her memories. And so, you know, she invents a whole new place. And the other people, I think, have, the ones we hear about anyway, have a sort of a combination of present experiences and past, but leaning more heavily to one or the other.
So you were born and raised in Milwaukee and attended Marquette University. How did your formative experiences in Milwaukee help shape the characters and direction of the novel? Did Milwaukee influence this novel at all?
Well, of course, Milwaukee influences everything that I write. My mother was a resident of Milwaukee, and she's in the novel. So in a sense, she is the model for one of the characters. Laverne Slatchek has a kind of Milwaukee name, I think. For that matter, so does Foster Kreswick. I looked at the names after a while, and I thought, you know, there are a lot of Polish names in this novel. And that, too, is, as is Stefaniak. So that's concrete evidence of Milwaukee in the novel. And the nursing home itself is not really based on one nursing home. It's based on, I mean, it's, you know, takes elements from a variety of them. My mother was in Milwaukee when she had a stroke. She lived in Milwaukee. And for a time after she had the stroke, we managed to keep her at home. We were able to return her as a result of, you know, a kind of family tag team effort so we could keep her at home. But then she had another brain event, and it was after that one that she wound up in the nursing home. So we had experiences with nursing homes in several different cities, as it turns out. And Milwaukee was one of them.
For me, the center of the book is the tender relationships that develop between the elderly residents at Pondside and their young caregivers. But also at the center of the book is a murder mystery. So you can see the novel for its thrilling mystery elements, but also, for me, for its tragic and comic elements. What sort of book did you set out to write? And does genre affect you while you're writing?
Well, I've never written a book that was specifically a mystery or murder mystery or thriller before. And one reason I turned to that is I thought if you set a book in a nursing home, which is generally not a very attractive environment for readers, right, or for anyone, then you need to give people something else to think about, including the characters in the novel. So they have both the mystery of what happened to Robert, and they also have the, it's another kind of mystery, but perhaps more urgent for many of them, which is how do we get back in the game, since they've also found themselves shut out of the game. So those things were very important so that everybody would have kind of a project that the old people and the young people would be equally invested in. And of course, Foster, who's inspired by the young man who made the jelly sandwich for my mother, he has more personal reasons for wanting to find out what really happened to Robert. But everybody has something they can, that puts them in cooperation with, in contact with, in urgent contact with other people, in both among the residents and among the staff. And that seemed to me that that is maybe that's a real challenge of a nursing home, is that it's hard to feel like a regular person there, both the visitors and the residents. It's hard for them to feel like they're still a human being with desires and interests and things they don't like and things they do. So using both the mystery and the video game, I was able to give them something else to focus on. And I wanted to show that they could focus on something else, that, you know, if there's something there, people will engage.
How do you hope readers will respond to this book in the sense that it focuses on the elderly and the young, people who are so often overlooked and marginalized in our society?
That's a very good question. First of all, I hope they'll read it, you know, and that would be good. And that is kind of a challenge, even reaching the audience, because the audience spans every audience, really, you know, in terms of age groups. Because if you're not young or you're not old, you're in between and you're thinking about your parents who are getting older, or, you know, everybody's a potential audience member. And, but how do you market that? How do you get it out there? So that's kind of a challenge. And I think that's one of the, reasons that the book is, this was another thing I'd never thought of, but turned out to be a good thing. And that was that mystery thrillers have an audience that does range across all age groups. So the fact that it's being marketed as a thriller or a mystery is fun for me. My previous novels were not. They were more, I don't know, you know, literary historical sort of novels. And one of them set largely in Milwaukee, as a matter of fact. But this just turned out to be quite a boon for marketing it. And what I would hope that all the readers would take away from it, actually, different ages would take away different things. I think, you know, an older reader might feel sort of seen, you know, not invisible. And that might be a big value of the novel right there. I think a sort of middle-aged reader who's perhaps has a loved one in a nursing home, right, also gets to feel seen, right, because it's a difficult situation. And there are characters that make that clear as well. And then young people, it's the two of the main characters are a CNA, right, a certified nursing assistant, a young man. And the other another young character who's very important is Foster, who works in the kitchen. But there's also a college student who's, you know, somebody's girlfriend. There are people who see that they have this same stake in this game, really, that everybody has this material in common. And of course, computer games aren't the only thing that old people and young people have in common, but it is what they have in common in this book.
Mary Helen, thank you so much for joining me here on Like Effect.
Thank you again, Chase, for inviting me.
Mary Helen Stefaniak is the author of The World of Pondside, and she spoke with WUWM's Chase Browning in April. Did you know that you can listen to Like Effect as a podcast? If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, just search for Like Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcasts to hear us on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Like Effect interviews. Coming up next, we'll take you to the Escuela Verde New Line Community Cafe and tell you about their mission of inclusion and education. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you're biking down the Hank Aaron State Trail or spending a day around the domes and looking for a cool drink, nestled right in Silver City is a student-run cafe. Working in partnership with New Line Education, students from Escuela Verde Public Charter School hone their barista skills and build real-world job experience. Jeremy Alt is an advisor and special education advisor at Escuela Verde. Lauren Luna and Jasper Schmiedel are students at Escuela Verde. They spoke to Lake Effect's Mallory Chang at the Escuela Verde New Line Community Cafe.
Thank you all so much for meeting with me here at Escuela Verde's New Line Community Cafe. Just to start off for Jeremy, Escuela Verde is a charter school focused on providing students hands-on learning and meeting students at where they're using eco-pedagogy. What exactly is eco-pedagogy?
Yeah, so we are a public charter school. We focus a lot on project-based learning. And so what that means is that we use a lot of students' interests to drive academic gains and to drive, like, our curriculums. So students and advisors co-create curriculums a lot based on their projects. We are Escuela Verde, so we do want our students to have a holistic understanding of why education is important and what their role is in society, but also with the environment as well. So we incorporate certain ecological principles into all of our coursework, into all of our projects. And we want students to think critically about their usage of the land, their usage of materials, how they as democratic citizens can impact the world for positive change towards sustainability goals, pollution and things like that. So ecopedagogy really means that we are rooting the student center, the student first, but also earth first too. It's an earth care and student care type of education.
And why open up a community cafe that is run by students under that whole umbrella of ecopedagogy?
Well, part of ecopedagogy is like ecological in the sense that it's like not just the biological environment, but also the community. And we value our community greatly. We're located here on the Silver City neighborhood in Milwaukee. And there was a lot of community members that were requesting cafes or public spaces for them to bring their families and to relax. And so many of our students come from this neighborhood and some of our staff. And so we saw an opportunity and a need in the community, and we wanted to partner with our community members and our students to create something that we all could be proud of, both as a school and as a neighborhood. So I think like the ecological pedagogy fits into that because we're trying to help look at the assets, not only of the community, but we want people in the community to see the assets that our young people have. Sometimes I think unfairly, young people on the outside might not be seen as constructive or productive members of our city, but they are, and they have some of the best ideas. And so we want this cafe to be a public-facing classroom for the community to see, like, look at everything that we have to offer.
Lauren and Jasper, you both are student baristas here at New Line Community Cafe in partnership with Escuela Verde. There's a barista class, and you learn the ins and outs of a cafe business. So I'll start with you, Lauren. Tell me a bit about what it's been like for you working in the cafe. Why did you want to be a part of this?
So working at the cafe is really fun, especially learning how to make all these different types of drinks and like learning how to actually run a business. I started being part of the cafe thinking it was not going to be true, but here we are a year later.
And what about you, Jasper? Why did you want to be a part of this cafe?
I love making coffee and I love meeting people here at the cafe. I'm doing both every day.
And for Lauren and Jasper, as a barista in the cafe, you're both really involved in the local community. And what has that been like for you? Do you have any moments that stick out for you?
It's been really nice working with the community. I really like the fact that every day there's like a new customer that walks in. It's like, hey, we live around the area and like we want to check out the cafe. So it's really cool.
On your website, it looks like you'll have a lot of community events with a lot of different partners and a lot of different people. And for Lauren and Jasper, with what you're learning in the cafe, how do you see yourself using these skills?
So one day in the future, I want to open my own bakery. So what I'm learning here, how to run the whole cafe, is really going to help me get to my goal of opening my own cafe. And like communicating with customers is also a really good skill, and that I'm still learning how to do really good, but that's going to help me very much in the future.
And Jasper, with the skills that you're learning at the cafe, how do you see yourself using these skills?
I know how to make many kinds of coffees. Ice mochas are my favorite, and I know how to keep the cafe clean. And I know how to work, so I just, I'm learning how to make change, and I've learned soft skills like communication, like when Jimmy says, I'm getting ready for lots of different kinds of jobs like Starbucks.
Oh, nice. And Jeremy, as the teacher that gets to oversee this program, what growth have you seen in your students who take on this role as a student barista at the cafe? What has been some pivotal moments that have been exciting for you?
Yeah, I would say that this is a definitely team effort. I'm lucky in that I get to help teach some of the courses, but this has been, we have about 10 advisors here that work, and Monica and Sarah are the two directly running the cafe. But from my perspective, the things that I see that are really powerful are honestly like communication skills and confidence. We want this space to be inclusive, not just right representative of the cultures that represent Silver City, but also inclusive in education, inclusive in the idea that anybody, any student can bring what they want into this space and be successful. So we have a lot of emergent bilingual students in this course. We have students with different disabilities and exceptionalities in this course. And so what I've seen is just a lot of confidence building, a lot of direct impacts into their transitional skills, which is an education term for transitioning into a job. So it's really different. Like, when you have a student with an IEP and a goal to say, like, oh, they're going to work on money math, or they're going to work on counting change, or they're going to, it hits a lot different when it's not just on a worksheet in a classroom, but it's happening real time with customers in a cafe, sometimes customers who might bring back a drink, sometimes customers who might have, like, you have to count out a lot of change. And I also, like, to Lauren's point, you know, I think it's also helping students to really understand that, number one, they have talents, they have things to offer, and they can dig deep and use these experiences to explore what their own passions are for when they graduate and what they want to do in the future.
Jeremy Ault is an advisor and special education advisor at Escuela Verde. Lauren Luna and Jasper Schmiedel are students at Escuela Verde. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang at the Escuela Verde New Line Community Cafe in June. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at the results of today's primary election and speak with the Pfister Hotel's artist in residence. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.